Hello, listeners. It's Don, alone in the studio this week. Before we start this special edition of Radio Free Thinker, I'd like to take a moment to express my condolences to Ethan and his family. Ethan's not here today because late last week his father passed away. I will save the eulogy for Ethan and a time and a place he would choose. That said, I think I can say with confidence, on the behalf of our listeners and fans, I send out to you, Ethan, our deepest wishes for compassion for you at this time of change, and may your memories bring you comfort. But the show must go on. So, it's the best of the 200th edition of Radio Free Thinker, a recap of some of the best segments from episode 200 to 209. This time, Parliamentary Budget Officer, Librarian Loyalty Oaths, Access to Information, and Panda Politics. Let's begin the best of the 200s.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of sparks. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker here on CITR.
You know, Ethan, we've talked before about, you know, some of the fundamental differences between our current government and our previous governments. You know, that the conservative government seems to be systematically and methodically attempting to shut down science research, silence public employees in their private lives. I mean, there is the change at Stats Canada, where in many ways they've kind of removed our ability to even know what's going on in our own nation. There's an assumption of secrecy where public documents are either outrightly censored, there are delays in their release, or they're just sort of lost in the mail. A lot of Freedom of Information Acts are experiencing extreme delays. It's very hard to get information out of the government. Well, the next front in the battle for Canada has occurred in our libraries and archives of Canada. A new code of conduct has been decreed and disseminated to all employees of the Federal Library and Archives of Canada, or also known as the LAC. The federal librarians and archivists who set foot in classrooms, attending conferences, or speaking up in public meetings on their own time are engaging in, quote, high-risk activities, at least according to this new code of conduct. Why? The code, which stresses federal employees' duty of loyalty to the duly elected government, it states, as a public servant, our duty of loyalty to the government of Canada and its elected officials extends beyond our workplace to our personal activities. So employees have to be extra careful that if they say something that may be critical, contradictory, or just inconvenient to the official government line, they may face disciplinary action or termination. For example, if you say something on Facebook or on your blog, and you make it personal, right? But it's an opinion you have about new department or Government of Canada programs, and you express it, like I say, to your friends or family, but through no fault of your own, it becomes public, and they know who sort of said it. Well, that public servant could be subject to disciplinary measures as a simple act of, again, just because I made it private doesn't mean that it couldn't possibly be public, therefore you're culpable. Now, this notion that civil servants owe a loyalty to the government smacks to me of a totalitarianism. It's what Hitler did in Germany, among others. They do not owe a loyalty to the government of Canada, but to the nation. They do not serve Harper and his conservatives, but they serve Canada. When we see or believe that a current government is causing harm to the nation, lying to the people, it's not the duty to just shut up. Your duty is to stand up and express their loyalty to the nation which they serve. The code has already had a chilling effect on federal archivists and librarians, who used to be encouraged to actively engage and interact with groups interested in things from genealogy to the preservation of historical documents. However, now they have to ask themselves, is it worth the risk of an accidental slip of the tongue and lose their career? Laurel McDonald, archivist at the University of Toronto, said, it is very disturbing and disconcerting to have included speaking at conferences and teaching as so-called, quote, high-risk activity. The code says employees may accept invitations as personal activities if six conditions are met. One, the subject of the activity is not related to the LEC's mandate or activities, so they really can't talk about what it is they're actually doing. The employee is not presented as speaking for or being an expert of the LEC or the Government of Canada. The third party that made the invitation is not potentially or currently a supplier or collaborator. of the LEC. The third party doesn't lobby or advocate with the LEC. The third party doesn't receive grant money, funding, or payments from the LEC. And the employee has discussed the invitation with his or her manager, who, quote, who has documented confirmation that activity does not conflict with the employee's duty at the LEC or present other risks to the LEC. So to summarize the requirements, you may not talk about things the government doesn't want you to. You cannot talk to people the government doesn't want you to. And most importantly, if you do speak as a private citizen, you must first get permission from the governmental overlords. Sieg Heil, anyone? It appears to rule out federal librarians or archivists interacting on their own time with academics, heritage, or genealogical groups or association, as they may actually lobby, collaborate, or receive funding from the LEC, including such things as going to your kid's school and telling them what you do for a living, because the schools are interrelated with library. It's crazy. It seems like an attempt to isolate all government employees from engaging with the public. So what does Harper have to fear? John Smart, a retiree who worked for the LEC for almost 20 years, says he believes the new code reflects a general suspicion of public servants by the Harper government. He says the LEC managers are likely not keen to have staff field questions about funding cuts, changes to the LEC, which are eliminating several specialty positions. They are moving to more digital archives, and they're reducing public access to the archival collection. Now, of course, this has inspired the poet in me, so brace yourself. So first they came for the scientists, and I said nothing. Then they came for the librarians. Again, I said nothing. Then they came for the teachers, the journalists, and the activists. And yet again, I said nothing. It was for the greater good, we were told. Then they came for me, and I was alone and too ignorant to know it.
Yeah.
Thoughts, Ethan?
Well, I mean, just keep this in mind when you vote next.
Yes.
You know, it's funny, in a not-so-funny kind of way, how just sort of adversarial this government has been to intellectualism. And I kind of, I try to remain as politically neutral as I can on this show, and I would be happy to point out examples of the NDP or the Liberal Party or the Bloc Québécois of being anti-intellectual jerks, but frankly, you know, the Harper government is really sort of monopolizing that aspect.
Well, you know, and there's you get a certain degree of false equivalency, because, I mean, to be fair, the Greens and the NDP quite often will side heavily with sort of the environmentalist, organic-y kind of things in their own sort of crazy way. But as you say, there isn't this, it's not even like they're for or against a particular political view or standpoint. It's that they don't want anyone to know what they're doing. And they're like, it's a different level, a different tone of how they're going about it that's most striking. I mean, I was listening to I guess it was The Current again or At Politics, and they were talking about a new change that they're making to not guilty by reason of insanity. There's a different term in Canada for that, but everyone knows that sort of thing. And, you know, they were saying that we need to have a rule that we can lock these people up for an extended period of time without sort of any ability for parole, and that only a judge can rescind this, and he can only do that after like 3 or 4 years of mandatory incarceration. And the interviewer was saying, well, you know, according to McGill University, which supplied the government with stats about this, it's only like 10% of the people who claim to have guilty but not by reason of insanity ever reoffend. So, I mean, it's a really minute number. And he came back, he says, oh, yes, but my staff has supplied me with numbers that say it's actually about a quarter to half of them reoffend. And she says, well, that's not the numbers we have. He said, oh, yes, I know, but those are the numbers that we have and that my staff has got me. And think about what he's saying there. So, one, he's giving information there's no way for us to confirm because it's internal documents. And by default, these internal documents are sort of secret documents that we're not allowed to see. And if we do see it, we'll see them maybe a year away after legislation has been passed and people don't know. Right now, you may or may not be aware that the parliamentary budget officer is in court trying to sue the government to find out what actually was in last year's budget. I mean, last year's budget, they said they were going to cut 20% from science. Right. And he says, OK, so where do you plan to cut the 20%? It's like, you don't need to know that. He says, well, how are we as MPs? And he's like, because he's working for Parliament. How are the MPs possibly supposed to know whether they agree with you or not if you don't actually tell them what it is you're doing? And there's this level of, I'm in charge. You don't need to know anything. Sit down and shut up and let me govern. If you have a problem with it, it's 2015. Then you can say something, and by then I'll probably bribe you.
It's like they've forgotten that our government is parliamentary democracy and not like, you know, sort of like we have a majority, ergo we just make whatever we want happen, like some countries.
Well, that was one of the ironies, is because this whole parliamentary budget office was a conservative idea that Harper supported, because he was annoyed at how what he saw the Liberal government doing these sort of shenanigans. You know, they'd say, hey, we're gonna buy this plane that's gonna cost a dollar, trust us. And he says, no, we want an independent, you know, budgetary office who can say, well, do the numbers really, really fit? And as soon as he appointed someone who I guess he thought was a safe bet, but actually believed in what he was saying, it's like, what the hell are you doing, you know?
Imagine that.
And the funny thing is the current guy who's in the job, he's not in the job anymore, actually, because he didn't quit. His term of office was over last Friday. And now they're sitting back, so who's going to replace it? Rumor has it that the position's going to remain vacant for at least an extended period of time, if not forever, because they've done that before. They had another one. They had, I think it was an elections officer to guarantee the integrity of elections. And that position was never filled for like 3 years, and then they just dissolved the department.
Yeah. Yeah, again, I think it speaks to sort of a lack of respect for the intellectual integrity of not just the government of Canada, but I think the people of Canada. And like I said, you know, I'd be happy to point out this kind of shenanigans if it was happening with another political party, but it just sort of seems like it's being monopolized by the Conservatives, and it's, you know, really ridiculous.
Well, I was just reading today, and granted, I don't agree with these people, but, you know, there is a backlash even within the own party ranks about the controlling nature of the particular Harper government, in that, you know, they're not allowed to talk about anything that hasn't already been pre-approved by the Prime Minister, that they're not allowed to bring up any motions unless they're pre-approved by the Minister, because he's afraid of democracy or something.
It is. It's an unfortunate train of events.
Subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes. Subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com. And we're back here on Radio Free Thinker.
Well, you know, Ethan, we like to cover topics that are black and white. Literally this week, it's black and white.
That's clever. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. So, Ershun, a 5-year-old female, and Damao, a 4-year-old male, will be spending 5 years in the Toronto Zoo, and then 5 years at the Calgary Zoo. This, you might say, well, what did they do, and why are you putting kids in jails? Well, these aren't kids. These are pandas.
Aww.
This will be the first long-term stay for the monochrome fuzzies in Canada. The Toronto, Calgary, and Winnipeg Zoo did host a pair of pandas for a few weeks in 1985, 88, and 89, respectively. So then I thought, well, you know, what are pandas, and why does anybody care? Although very iconic, my first thought was, besides being black and white and bare all over, what are they? The pandas we got are the giant panda kind, as opposed to the red panda. The giant panda is a bear, as opposed to its namesake, which actually is a raccoon, which kind of makes you wonder why they're called panda. But they are native to central, west, and southwestern China. Of course, we've all known the iconic image of the black and white furballs. Interestingly enough, although bears, and thus member of the order Carnivora, or carnivores, their diet is actually 99% bamboo. That said, they will, in the wild, munch on other plants like grass and tubers, and opportunity arises, they'll munch on a bird or a rodent, and they're not above taking a nibble of a bit of carrion if given the chance. So,
aren't most bears, though, sort of like omnivores like that, though?
Yes, but most of them are more omnivores on the meat side as opposed to the plant side. But you are right. He's weird, but he's like your Uncle Phil weird, not like from another planet.
Right, right.
Not elf weird.
Sure.
In captivity, they receive honey, eggs, fish, yam, shrub leaves, oranges, and bananas, along with specially prepared food, and of course bamboo, which is flown in twice weekly from Memphis. Why Memphis, you say? Well, apparently Memphis was host to a couple of pandas, which apparently are returning to China this year. So, and Memphis is in Tennessee. Tennessee is much more conducive to the growing of bamboo than Ontario, unless, of course, you're talking about Chinese restaurants where bamboo's everywhere, but probably not enough to feed the two hungry pandas. Your typical panda lives for about two decades in the wild, and a third decade in captivity, the oldest one being about 34. Pandas are an endangered species, which is not as bad as it may sound. I mean, you sit there and you go, oh, they're the conic for endangeredness. They are at risk of extinction in the near future, but on the scale of risks established by international treaty, it's kind of like a scale between 1 and 7, they're actually about halfway, they're like right in the middle of the scale. It's kind of a weird system established by the treaties. They have 7 classifications. 2 are not really a risk at all. 2 are already sort of extinct. Well, 1's extinct in the wild and 1 is extinct.
Mm-hmm.
And then they sort of have the 3 in the middle. And those sort of those creatures that are vulnerable, so creatures that could go extinct if we don't keep an eye on them in the future. So think of things like flying squirrel, harbor seal. There are the critically endangered, which are more like the, oh my God, they're going to go extinct any day now, game over man sort of thing. And that's like the Java rhino, mountain gorilla. And then, of course, you have the panda, which is, like I say, right in the middle. Not an immediate risk of extinction, but all signs point that in their future, there's a good chance it's not going to be there. There are about actually 4,000 animals on the endangered list, which I guess is a bad thing. The wild population is believed to be about less than 2,000, although numbers vary from anywhere from 1,000 to 3,000. And there's a captive community of about 300. The biggest threat to the panda population is its loss of habitat and their Puritan values. What's that you say? Puritan values? Well, besides being famous for being lazy bamboo chompers, it seems the reproductive instincts of the panda is, how shall we say, a tad on the sluggish side. The female goes into estrus for about 48 hours, plus or minus, once a year. So you think that the males would be, well, eager for the event. It seems, at least in captivity, the males are more interested in lying around than lying around, if you know what I mean. desperate conservatives, people who protect the environment, have resorted to things like artificial insemination, keeping the couple really close together so that if anything does spark, they'll have opportunity to leap on it. They've even used Viagra in the males, and they've even resorted to panda porn. Yes, panda porn. I suspect right now some of you are in the Google trying to find, what does panda porn look like? Although if you're in the fuzzy community, I guess you already know about that.
Yeah.
Furry, sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they have improved their technique by studying black bear populations, and it seems that females are really only interested in sex about every couple of years. So I'm thinking more very British-sounding couples here.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so that's a panda. What's panda politics? It seems that the Chinese have known for a long time that pandas have a direct line to the cute center of the human brain. To that end, China has used its monopoly of the supply of pandas as a way to gain favor with other nations who just can't seem to resist the monochrome little furballs. As far back as the 7th century, the Chinese emperors have given pairs of pandas to places like Japan as a way of cementing diplomatic ties. The modern practice arose after the Chinese Civil War, and from 1958 to 1984, China gave away about 28 pandas to about 8 countries. The first was to the Soviet Union in 1958. Korea received several over the next decade. The most famous, though, went to the most hated politician in U.S. history after George Bush, maybe Obama if you believe Fox News, but it went to Nixon. Yes, when Nixon went to the communist China to open up diplomatic relations, the communist government gave him the most famous pair of pandas, Ling Ling and Xing Xing, and they went to Washington where they lived out their lives.
Hmm.
To help grow ties with the West, China thought China, although communist, had always been in a love-hate relationship with the Soviet Union. So after the Americans got their pandas in 1972, Japan, Germany, France, and the UK also got the same. After 1982, China changed from giving pandas to loaning them, or some people say pimping them out. The term of the loan was for 10 years at a cost of $1 million a year. So the Chinese government earns about $10 million for loaning the pandas to Canada. As well, of course, the host nation must supply room and board and accommodations for the guests. Room and board, paid for by the Toronto Zoo, is about $8 million for the house and $2 million a year for board and maintenance. In the U.S., fears that the Chinese government was simply pimping out the pandas, there was a lawsuit by the World Wildlife Federation that resulted in a U.S. law stating that if the U.S. hosted pandas, at least half of the money paid would go towards panda conservation. And now most of the readings that I have done has gone to assume that this $10 million goes directly to panda conservation. So this doesn't seem to be quite a mechanism for China to make money off of.
Yeah.
Now, there are some real politics involved. In 1998, China offered two pandas to Taiwan, but Taiwan rejected them because when China responded to something called CITES, that the transfer was actually a domestic activity and not international. Yes, and so CITES stands for Conservation on International Trade in Endangered Species, and is the body sort of responsible for policing the various endangered animal treaties around the world. Anyway, Taiwan considers itself an independent nation, while mainland China has always considered itself a wayward province. So Taiwan rejected the pandas twice, once in 1998 and again in 2005, because it wanted this interaction to be between two equal nations and not a province and a mother country. In 2008, after a political change in Taiwan, when a pro-China government took office, the offer of pandas were actually accepted. But then, when CITES stated that it considered it to be sort of an internal matter, the Taiwanese government issued a rebuttal to CITES stating that they had followed all the regulations required for endangered when moving from one nation to another nation. So, pandas are politically hot potatoes. So, why did Toronto get some pandas? When Nixon went to China, it was a political gambit. The relationship between China and the Soviet Union was at a low, and this was seen as a good time to widen the wedge between the world's two dominant communist nations. In hindsight, it seemed to have worked. Harper has put economics ahead of politics and hoping to create a, quote, strategic partnership with Canada. To put it in the devil's, I mean, in Harper's own words, our country is looking for new markets for our goods and services, and in the area of in an area of tremendous opportunity. We hope to expand our strategic partnership with China, and in particular, we hope to deepen the economic and trade ties between our two nations. Peter Harder, a former Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs and now President of the Canada-China Business Council, put it like this: I would attach great significance to the fact that China would place in Canada's care the pandas that are coming. It's a signal of their desire to have economic as well as cultural and people-to-people relationships. And to that extent, I think it's a significant development. The panda politics in this case has been sort of thrown in reverse. Instead of China sort of seeking favor with foreign nations by offering pandas, Canada is sort of attempting to say that it's willing to play ball with China, and pandas are being lent to the nation as sort of the Chinese government is saying that, yes, yes, you've done quite good, and here's your reward for doing well. Some observers, notably the Financial Post, sees it as an economic sell to China that has already had too much influence in Canada and with little regard to playing sort of by Western rules with regards to things like international property rights, intellectual rights, and international espionage. So, is it appropriate for Harper to sort of greet the pandas while ignoring perhaps more important things? There's been a lot of criticism about Harper taking time out of his schedule to officially welcome the landing of the pandas. They will not actually be viewable outside of in a plastic box for several weeks because they're spending time in quarantine. While in Toronto, Harper missed a chance to address a crowd of thousands of the Idle No More movement as they greeted over 400, quote, Cree walkers who have traveled by snowshoe to Ottawa, some of them over 1,600 kilometers. Aboriginal Affairs Minister Bernard Valcour did say he will eventually meet with them and see what they have to say. Another criticism was Harper being able to clear time for the pandas, but was not able to meet with the provincial premiers as the group discussed the economy, healthcare, and other things. He actually sort of snubbed the premiers last year when they had the annual meeting in the Maritimes, and he just didn't bother to show up. Too busy. Now, it might have been nice for him to get some face-to-face opinions about, you know, the upcoming budget by talking to the premiers. But again, you know, he had his own economic plan and he was going to go for it. Now, recent leaks and documents released have shown that when it comes to things like big oil, which was a big one just recently that came out, and other corporate interests, Harper government seems to take a great effort and time to ensure that they serve the needs of the business class. Likewise, the main function of the mission to China a year ago was not to get the pandas, but to ensure that China knew Canada was for sale, open for business. It seems that the successful request of the pandas came directly from Harper, but under a implied condition by the Chinese government that the Harper would travel to China to make the announcement personally. So it was a sort of a PR stunt for China to have one of these Western leaders come there and say, listen, we like China, China is good. So far, it seems the arrival of the pandas was a perfect photo opportunity for Harper, a man known to sort of manufacture stage sets to make him look more human. So far, so good for him. One could wonder what else was put on the table to entice the Chinese, who had been refusing earlier requests for over a decade, to give in and loan us a panda. Now, to be fair, correlation is not causation. But correlation does show us that Canada has signed the China-Canada Foreign Investment Promotion and Protection Agreement, which many on the left, right, and center have complained is very one-sided. It strengthens Chinese private and state ownership corporation rights at the expense of Canadian sovereignty. China, in the middle of last year, purchased a major player in the tar sands, which, to the consternation of those who worried about foreign national ownership of Canadian resources, they purchased Nexen for over $15 billion. Well, China didn't. It was the Chinese National Offshore Oil Corporation. And in China, a lot of debate has been going on is how independent are national companies in a communist state. There's a lot of debate there. But in Canada, sold half of its share in Alberta shale gas to PetroChina just prior to the Chinese changing their mind on pandas. The China Petroleum and Chemical Corporation purchased for $2 billion the Canadian oil and gas firm Daylight Energy at about the same time. It previously got the Harper government to approve a $4.5 billion stake in Syncrude Canada, one of the world's largest producer of synthetic crude oil from the oil tar sands and the largest single source producer in Canada. At the time, many commentators worried about the influence of the Chinese government over Canada and its politics. Well, it seems that things have gone quite well for China, but at least we get some pandas for a decade. Yay, Harper.
Yeah. I kind of can't help but feel that, like, the polar bears are sort of sitting, you know, under dwindling piles of ice going, we're cute too.
Well, you know, some of the things that I was reading about with this, and a lot of people were complaining, is it's $10 million. So what did they close recently that was only costing them a couple million to keep open? The environmental lakes thing, right? So, I mean, it's nice that you have this little touristy thing, right? A little prestige for Harper. But as far as was it in the best interest of Canada, that's a much harder case to sort of to make, considering we're in a time of austerity and such things. Can we really, I mean, do we really need $2 billion for a bunch of black and white fluffballs?
Yeah, I mean, frankly, I don't quite get the obsession with pandas myself, or really, well, zoos in general. But anyway, I mean, the thing that's frustrating about this is how it's sort of being spun as some kind of twisted form of environmentalism, that by bringing these pandas over, which, as you talked about, are you know, evolution is trying its hardest to get rid of these things. and we're, like, literally giving them pornography, urging them, can we say something else? Like, humpback whales, for instance. They're cool. They're neat. Let's save them.
I get the feeling that, like, you know, the pandas have their roommate has called the suicide prevention line, and they've literally taped the phone to the ears of the panda saying, come on, man.
Yeah.
You want to keep going? Nah, I don't want to. But, you know, one thing that's kind of interesting, because pandas are kind of unique. I mean, like polar bears, right? I mean, we don't send polar bears around the world as a form of diplomatic prestige, right? Mm. Actually, the only other case that I come up with that was kind of similar to this was the Seychelles Islands apparently gave to China a pair of rare tortoises that they have in their island, as sort of a, you know, it was for like 1910, I guess, the Beijing Olympics sort of thing, right? And it was sort of like, hey, these are rare. Why don't you grab a few and, you know, and
what about India with the tigers?
Yeah, no, again, I think the closest thing that we have to that is whenever the queen comes here, we kill a beaver and give her a hat.
Yeah.
Which is tradition. But it's quite famous. I mean, like the panda tradition, as like China has used it as such a great symbol of its largesse. You know, I mean, it first of all came off saying, hey, we've got this unique thing. Do you want to have one? And I mean, you may not know, because I mean, you're not a student of history. You are. But Nixon going to China was such a huge thing, and it's such a visible image of the Washington Zoo getting a pair of pandas in the United States. Actually, did you know that if our pandas that we're borrowing have babies, they don't actually get Canadian citizenship, so they can't be anchor babies, which is one thing that, well, no one was really worried about, but I thought was, someone had commented on it, that was funny. But the old ones, the original ones that were given away, those actually have, that's why you can get some, like London, I think, still has one. Americans have a few that are their own, that are not gifts, but they're...
Well, I should say that I don't disparage the action of gift-giving between nations. I think that's actually a good thing. I think that if we can cement ties with China through economics, as long as they're not, you know, backroom dealing, nefarious economics, as long as they're fair economics, that's great, because that just means that we're less likely to go to war with China. But I think that we need to perhaps rationally examine here the concept of fair and open economics that are subject to fair and open criticism. And that doesn't seem to be what's happening here.
Well, that actually, that leads into two very distinctive conversations going on here. One thing, which we can discuss maybe, is the idea that a lot of people, a lot of capitalists, say that China doesn't play fair. That, you know, sure, you can try and have ties with China, but you can't use the same rules that you would do if you were going to do a trade deal with the UK or the United States. But it seems like Harper, among others, are trying to do this, well, you know, we'll scratch your back, you scratch our back sort of politics. The other thing I heard about, and I guess I'm happy about this if it's a true rumor, but that Harper may be stepping down from politics in the next coming year or two, and that this is one way for him to sort of cement his legacy. And
what a crappy legacy.
well, but that leads into the other thing. I mean, we've been talking earlier in the show about how very authoritarian, very, you know, totalitarian sort of the Harper government has been, and you wonder, well, how much does he think in his own mind that, well, if getting pandas for Canada is in my / the party's best interest, quote, the government of Canada, is it really worth giving up Canadian sovereignty over our oil sands, our tar sands? Is it really worth giving, you know, up these other things because it benefits the party, and the party is Canada, at least in his own mind?
Well, I mean, you could look at it from, I guess, a different angle, and that is whether or not, in some way, Harper or people who are sort of behind this actually think they're helping Canada. Like, you, if we put ourselves in their shoes, do they actually think that they're doing us a big favor, and that, you know, in 20 years we're going to be like, well, it's a really good thing we cemented trade relations with China.
Well, that's the thing that I can't get into his mindset, is does he think what is good for the Conservative government, that is what's good for Canada? And that even if Canada in itself becomes a wasteland, if the party's still doing good, then that is by definition in Canada's. Because as I was mentioning in the duty of loyalty, it wasn't duty of loyalty to Canada, it was duty and loyalty to the government of Canada.
Yeah.
And that's a hair that you can slice many different ways.
Well, that's true. I'm reminded of, you know, sort of the rhetoric that came out of the Bush administration in America was that history was going to vindicate us. Like, right now, the war in Iraq looks stupid, but in like 20 years, people are going to be like, that was such a good move. You know, and I have to wonder, like, you know, we've talked about in the skeptic movement to sort of bring in some other angles to this of taking sort of the charitable angle, of trying to think of the best possible way to look at somebody else's point of view. And I have to wonder if he's thinking to the point that I figured out how to make the world better, make Canada better, but nobody's going to agree with me, so I have to do it this way, and that one day I will be vindicated, and that he honestly thinks I'm doing the right thing, even if, you know, everyone's going to complain and everyone's going to be mad at me, I've done the right thing. And I have to wonder, like, if that's the case, not that I'm excusing him or anything, but if that's the case, then it does give you a slightly different view of him as opposed to sort of the evil tyrant view.
Yeah, but somehow that just makes it even scarier.
I'm not saying it makes it better. I'm just saying it's a different way of looking at it. I try to find a rational explanation for why politicians do what they do. Because I think looking at them as sort of like kind of cartoonish villains is not helpful. It doesn't help the rhetoric when we compare Harper to a Nazi. We need to figure out why he's doing what he's doing so that we can formulate public discussions about why this is not a good idea or why we need a change in politics.
Sorry, just because you made it to get me. So making an analogy to a Nazi isn't necessarily a wrong thing if you're trying to say, well, I mean, Hitler, I have to believe, thought he was doing what was best for the nation.
Yeah.
Right? That the Nazi party thought that they were doing what was best for the nation. So in that sense, obviously, it's very much a difference in quantity, right? And there are no death camps in Alberta that we know of. Right? And you do take it with a grain of salt.
Right.
But at the same time, actually, and you just said it yourself, that if you go to an ideological standpoint, a dogmatic standpoint, that I know, irrespective of anyone else's opinion or current evidence, that what I'm doing is right, and it may take a generation for you to know it, but I'm going to do it come hell or high water, I don't think that's an unfair comparison.
But what about, though, like, you know, if you brought up, say, like Lincoln. Not everyone agreed with Lincoln that what he was doing and, you know, ending slavery was a good thing. You know, you could argue that close to like 75% of the country was, you know, not in his corner on that particular
That depends whether you count the blacks or not. But.
Well, the argument could be made. I think that there is reasonable a certain... reason to take the assumption that if someone does believe that they are doing the right thing, even though no one else agrees with them, it's not necessarily indicative that they've gone the way of Hitler.
True, but then I don't know whether you're saying that in expanding human rights and freeing a people who have been subjected to slavery is what Harper is currently doing by selling off
our resources to
China.
I'm not suggesting that. I'm just using Lincoln as an example.
There's an interesting bifurcation. I mean, they're opposite polars in some ways, but is someone who is dogmatic, and we're going to say delusional just to tamper, is he a Lincoln or is he a Hitler? Because you could both say that both of them were off it from their own relative... Context.
Well, I mean, Lincoln was kind of tyrannical in his politics.
Yeah, and Hitler was the most popular politician in German history.
Well, at least until, you know, the 1940s.
Yes. Well, actually, depending on how you say up to. So maybe you're right. In that sense, maybe my Hitler comparison does fall down, because most people do agree that Harper is far from the most popular politician we've ever had.
Like I said, I, either way, that's sort of off the point. I mean, I think where we need to develop our skepticism in this political arena is trying to sort of open that door of figuring out what the heck are you thinking. I mean, we need to know, because we need to know whether or not he's right, probably not, but we need to know just so that we can formulate an argument.
I know, and I agree. And I think this is how he works against himself in some degrees, or the government's working against itself, is because it has sort of shut down all the channels of communication and limited knowledge to a bare minimum, it's almost impossible for us to make that assessment.
Yeah.
Right? But you are right. I mean, we should not get ideological in our judgment, even if someone is evil. I mean, like Harper. So actually, I'd be curious to know if any of our listeners out there have any equivalent examples of how the other parties, other nations, have done sort of similar, unique adventures as our panda policy and the things that Harper government are doing.
Yes.
Standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck. I'm just a speck compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Well, Don, shifting gears a little bit, we have some news about science and censorship here in Canada.
Yes, so... The Unaccessed to Information. Ooh, what a clever title.
Mm.
Well, it's too early to say things may be getting better in the government providing information. There does seem to be light at the end of this sort of stonewalling tunnel. We often talk on the show about the shutdown of the flow of material from government agencies and employees to the public. Information is essential for the operation of a rational democratic nation. Well, in response to complaints jointly filed by Democracy Watch and the University of Victoria's Environmental Law Clinic, Canada's Information Commissioner, Suzanne Leggett, announced her office will be investigating whether the Harper government is living up to the law of the land. In this case, the Access to Information Act, which states that access to information requests must be answered within 30 days, but it does allow departments to grant themselves essentially unlimited extensions. Earlier this year, Leggett publicly explained that even with generous terms given the government, they are still exceeding their own extended deadlines. She noted that the response times have notably increased since the Conservatives gained a majority. So they can create their own sort of extensions, and even when they do that, they don't even meet their own extensions, which is really kind of bizarre. Now, government officials complain the nature of the request and the complexity of government makes them harder to fill out. That's why there's this extended delays. Legault dismisses this statement by stating that there's no clear evidence that the requests are becoming more complex to process. It should actually be noted that improvements in digital records should actually increase the efficiency and reduce response times for these requests. Besides this complaint, the Information Commissioner is taking the Department of Defense to court over information requests, which the department slapped a 1,100-day extension. That's like 30 days plus 3 years. I mean, that's ridiculous. So the extension is being argued that it's a deliberate obstruction and a violation of the principles of the Information Act. In an interview to the CBC, it was pointed out that by 2011, less than 20% of the access to information requests to the federal departments and agencies were met with full disclosures of the information. So, you know, if you ever see these sort of documents released and they go on the internet and there's all this blacked out area, well, that's what that's referring to. So even when they sort of fulfill with the documents, a lot of the information, and who knows how important that information may or may not be, has been blacked out. So it's perhaps not surprising that an international survey taken last year ranked Canada 55th out of 93 countries in terms of access to information. In a press release by Reporters Without Borders, a ranking of countries on its Medium Freedom survey dropped Canada 10 points from its previous survey to 20 out of 90. So we're 20th out of 90, and we went down 10 points. The group states that the reason for the drop was due to obstruction of journalists during the so-called Maple Spring student protest and to continued threats of confidentiality of journalists' sources and internet users' personal data, in particular because of the C-30 bill on cybercrime. That was the one that says you either support the government or you're a pedophile. Our access to information law was created in 1983 and hasn't been updated since. When it first was promulgated, it was actually the envy of the world. Everyone said, wow, you guys have done such a great job with this. But now we're sort of like that old man on the corner who's sort of saying inappropriate things at international conferences, i.e. most nations have surpassed our standards, notably updates because of the information technology revolution that's occurred, right? According to a report card issued last year by the Leggett, the information officer, the timeline for request being fulfilled by the Canadian Food Inspection Agency, the Department of Northern Indian Affairs, and Transportation Canada were all given Fs. And notably, one of the important ones there is Canadian Food Inspection Agency, which is responsible for food safety. And if you remember, there was the big XL food scandal of getting poisoned meat with E. coli. So, again, all this was sort of spurred on by Democracy Watch and University of Vic's complaint about that. Part of this, the legate and the information officer asked for, you know, well, what should we change? What could make things better? So in response to the many loopholes that are existing in access to information, Democracy Watch proposed eight particular changes. One, any type of record created by an entity that receives significant funding, is connected to the government, or created by a government law or fulfills the public interest, should automatically be covered by the law. So, you know, BC Hydro, which is still publicly owned, isn't it?
We'll pretend it is. Yeah.
You know, because it serves a public function. Even if it was privately owned, because it is a utility and it serves a huge public function, it should fall under the Freedom of Information Act. Access to Information Act. Freedom of Information is the American one. My apologies. All exemptions under the Act to provide information should be discretionary, but there should be limits, that there needs to be a proof of harm test, and that public interest can even override these. So, you know, you have to prove that there'd be harm done if this information was released. Right now, there's sort of the default position that, do we have to release this? No, then great, we won't. And that's sort of the default. The Access to Information Law and System should require that every entity covered to create detailed records of the decisions, actions, factual and policy research, routinely disclose the records that they are required to assign responsibility to individuals to both create and maintain such records, and to maintain each record so that it's easily accessible. So essentially it's saying, you know, any piece of paperwork that an entity creates that has to do with its operation should be correlated and collected, and an indexed record kept. The Access to Information Law should allow that anyone who does factual or policy research for the government be allowed to speak to the media and the public about that topic. So if we're paying a scientist to do research, that scientist should be encouraged, actually, to go out and interact with the public about the research that they have done. Severe penalties should be created for not creating the records, for not maintaining the records, or for unjustifiable delays in this. Right now, the information officer that is responsible can give a report, but there's no teeth to the particular act in itself. The information commissioner should be given explicit powers under the act in order to release records, to penalize violations of the law, and to require changes where a department doesn't actually comply with it. So to go in and say, listen, you have a problem here, you need to fix this, and you need to fix it now, or here's how you're going to fix it. Access information system and enforcement should be increased to solve backlog problems and reduce the fees and overall increase standardization, i.e. try and get rid of the barriers that are put up almost artificially to the access of information, that it should be a free-flowing system, and that if you need to put more money into it, that's a very important, it's as important in many ways in Canada, maybe more important than the idea of defense. I mean, this is information democracy needs to get a hold of. And that most importantly, Parliament should be required to review the Access to Information Act every 5 years to correct any problems, to ensure that it's kept up to date with modern issues. So that's one part of it. Then this even gets more convoluted when we factor in perhaps the intentional or unintentional collateral blocks. So Legault, who has been at her job for 3 years, has says that her department has suffered an 8% budget cut. And she has to deal with over 7,000 complaints and has 2,000 left. And with less and less money, she can't do her job. And this gets, you know, cascading down, because if the Canadian Inspection Agency loses 10% of its budget, not only does it not inspect the meat, but it literally does not have staff to get the information that you need to get that. Mm-hmm. 7,000 complaints in 3 years. That works out to over 6 complaints every day. Legault says that in the last 6 months, she's seen a sharp rise in a number of complaints with the department and about departments and improper delays to responses for access information requests. To which, again, she says it's budget cuts, you know, which leads to staff cuts, which again leads to reduction of service and lack of information. I don't think it's a plot or conspiracy. Well, no, I do. I think to a certain degree, I think Harper has made a conscious decision to say, listen, you know, if there's less information out there, there's less things for people to trip us up on. And as a party, as our election strategy, it's going to be easier for us. Right? And I'm willing to set that. But then there's also this other idea that we need to cut back government, cut back government. And people sort of think, well, you know, my taxes will be lower and that's the end of it. You lose services. And part of the services that we're focusing on right here is to know even what the heck the government's doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It seems like it's a kind of a no-brainer that you'd want to have those services in place. And it does kind of have that veneer that this is so sensible that they will never allow it because it's just too sensible. You know, I mean, it has to be crazy and rigorous and stupid for them to accept it.
You know, and like I say, a lot of these are sort of accidental. I mean, one thing to always remember, for reporters, for example, right, if they want to go out a news story, they have a very short deadline. Mm. So, you know, the government says, well, you know, we've never denied a request of X, Y, or Z. But what they have done is the reporter goes in and says, hey, I want to talk to scientist A. And first of all, to distinguish between us and the Americans, and we always look at Americans as, ooh, evil and all that sort of thing. In the United States, they just phone the scientist up and says, hey, can you talk about this? Here, you have to phone the government official who will arrange for an interview. And of course, when they do that, they got to get approval from their boss and sometimes their boss's boss and so on and so on. So hours, days, weeks, sometimes never. And these delays, reporters just, they can't deal with them. So they say, well, okay, I won't get that information. In fact, there was a little over a year ago, a very famous report done by a Canadian-funded scientist about the fisheries, West Coast fisheries. And sort of the report had gone out, and they sort of hold on to it for a few days so that reporters can, you know, do a bit of research. They can talk to other people to get a handle on it. It's called an embargo. Right? So Scientific America, got this report from this Canadian scientist and said, wow, this is such a big thing. It sent out thousands and thousands of press releases, for lack of a better word, saying, hey, this report's coming out. It's really, really important. You need to get a good handle on it. So obviously everyone tried to get a hold of this particular scientist. And she was not allowed to talk until after it was actually published. And then they did a Freedom of Information Act, one of the ones that went through. And it found out that she was willing to talk, her handlers were willing to let her talk. It ended up going to the PMO's office, and at that level they said, no, she's not allowed to talk, which just really puts a scary spin on the whole topic.
Yeah, it really does. Well, we should take a quick break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll come back with more after this right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
This is Phil Plait of BadAstronomy.com, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM for UBC in Vancouver, British Columbia.
We're back on Radio Free Thinker.
So, Ethan, I don't know if you know this, but a couple of weeks ago, the first and likely the last parliamentary budget officer ended his term. The PBO, it's parliamentary budget, sounds a little nerdy, but it's really kind of important to democracy. So I thought maybe we should cover it a little bit on the show, just so people are aware of sort of what it is, what's at stake, and why they should care. For those who don't know, Kevin Page, who was the PBO, a longtime conservative, former friend of Stephen Harper, a member of the Prime Minister's office, and appointed by said Harper to stand as Canada's first PBO officer, and he stepped down a few weeks ago. The PBO was a campaign promise of the Conservative Party and the brainchild of Harper. The Conservatives and other parties were constantly complaining that the then previous Liberal governments were fiddling with the budget number to win elections and make themselves and their ideas more palatable than what the real figures would have led one to believe. The PBO was envisioned to be an independent office that could crunch the numbers and provide Parliament with an objective, nonpartisan analysis of government budgetary items. It was to ensure and provide open and transparent reporting. It was to be able to define its own research agenda while simultaneously responding to incoming requests from Parliament and committees. So it was allowed to basically free rein to investigate any part of the budget that it thought, hey, this could be important. Let's see if the numbers really work out. Shortly after winning his minority government, Harper enacted his dream in the Financial Accountability Act. He then appointed Kevin Page as Canada's first PBO officer. Page stepped down a few weeks ago, and it looks like there will be no replacement. Why, you may ask? Well, it seems that Page took his job seriously, and Harper realized that a good idea as opposition may not look so good when you're in power. The PBO made waves when in 2011 it provided an analysis of the F-35 jet fighter purchase that showed that the true cost would be more than three times as expensive than what was reported by the department. His numbers showed that a cost of $29 billion plus $4 billion for upgrades, while the official numbers pegged it costed only $9 billion. Along with the damning report by the Auditor General that also pointed out the F-35 selection process was not based on tendering process, as it should have been, well, the Harper government had to backpedal. So for now, the F-35, they're saying they're going to revisit the choice and they're going to entertain competing bids. Needless to say, a lot of egg on Harper's face. The PBO last year released an analysis of the projected costs over the next 7 years of benefits to elderly. It concluded the cost would rise for a number of years relative to GDP, but then fall back very close to current levels. This report contradicted the government statement that the old age security was unsustainable. Again, a meme you hear a lot on the conservative side. And if you think about it, I mean, there's going to be a bit of a bump in old age security as the baby boomers reach that age, but they're also going to disappear from the old age security as they literally die off. So it always struck me as a weird one to peg your hat on. The office has also released reports questioning Harper's numbers on things like the crime bill and other legislation, again, essentially being a bit of a thorn in the dogmatic Harper side. One of the biggest points of contention was his inability or the delays in getting access to necessary information from various departments. Here we go again with the conservative government wanting to keep not only the public, but in this case, our elected representatives in Parliament in the dark. In performing an analysis into the 2012 budget, the PBO was faced with a number of large government departments that refused to disclose the numbers of job cuts and how much services in each department would be affected. Major ministers, such as Flattery in Finance and Clements in the Treasury Board, have outright refused to cooperate, stating that the PBO was going beyond his mandate. The PBO is actually divided into two divisions, one for economic and fiscal analysis, general economic and financial analysis, outlooks and sort of risk assessment, how are things going in the future. The other is expenditure and revenue analysis, which is directly tasked with analyzing programs' cost, estimates, assessment of budgetary systems, and providing cost estimates for parliamentary proposals. Essentially, this is exactly what they're supposed to be doing. MPs have complained while defending the PBO that it's very hard for them to vote on a budget when the budget doesn't actually say what it's going to do. I mean, for example, Flattery says that he's going to reduce Fishery and Oceans budget by 5%. Well, what exactly does that mean? Well, it could mean they'll switch from disposable coffee cups to reusable ones, or it could mean that they're going to shut down the Environmental Lakes Area project, which has been running for over 40 years. You might say okay to the first one, but I suspect many MPs would not have said yes to the latter. The PBO argues that it's his job to inform parliamentarians and the public about what a $5.2 billion cut will do to the government and has gone to the courts to gain access for the required documents. Another aspect that Page is fighting for change was where his office sat in the government hierarchy. The PBO is attached to the Library of Parliament. Although a library, it's not a public one, or only at least selected amounts of it are released to the public. As such, anything that the PBO publishes could be labeled as secret or the librarian's equivalent, and thus neither the public nor the non-executive parliamentarians would actually have ready access to what he's reported. On top of that, under current legislation, the position was appointed by and works at the pleasure of the Prime Minister. A private member's bill reflecting the recommendations of Page was to make the PBO independent, directly reporting to Parliament, and appointed by a non-partisan parliamentary committee. It should be noted that the interim head of the PBO is the parliamentary librarian, Sonia Leroux. On this appointment, Page commented that Leroux, as a librarian, reports directly to the Speaker of the Senate and the House, again, further questioning the independence of the particular office. He also noted that as sort of the budget watchdog, she's never actually ever worked on a budget, and that this sort of sends a strong signal that they don't want somebody acting in a position that actually knows what they're doing, that they actually have knowledge and experience in the area. Quote, if the government wanted to send a strong signal that they wanted a true legislative budget officer, they would have appointed somebody on an interim basis from within the office. Instead, they are looking for someone who is, quote, tactful and discreet, good at achieving consensus. So, sort of my last word on this. If we had a minority government, it would be possible to change the legislation to make the PBO a true pillar of democratic governance. Those who complain that minority governments are bad should take a look at what happened in the last couple of years under the Harper government and ask themselves, if given the chance, would you have changed your vote? So I guess, having said all that, The big takeaway here is that governments will often say one thing, but when it comes to time to actually do it, the details can be really, really important. I mean, quite often they will sit there and they'll say, for example, we're going to restrict certain chemicals that are allowed to be used for pesticides. What qualifies as organic? We had that on the show before. But outside of saying we'll define it, it then goes to a smaller committee or it goes to a department where they actually weed out all the nitty-gritty. And quite often, it's the nitty-gritty that's where the meat of the issue is. As I pointed out, to sit there and say you're going to cut Transportation Canada, a food inspection agency, right? No, actually, the best one, just recently, that's been in the news, is Revenue Canada, right? They're cutting funding to Revenue Canada, but they say they're increasing the number of people who are going to be investigating fraud. Well, those two seem contradictory, and that's where the PBO would go in there, and he'd say, well, so how exactly are you going to do this? What are the details? And provide that information to both the parliamentarians, who are important, but also to the public, so that we know what's actually going on.
Well, you know, it's interesting as well because you mentioned how there's different sort of departments and there's a question of how much autonomy do these departments have within the government. And it strikes me that our government, the way we structure it, is designed to give a lot of autonomy to the individuals working in a department so that depending on the personality of the person in charge, you may have a very secretive department or a very kind of fly-by-night kind of whatever goes. And it just sort of seems that this is a very inefficient way to run a country.
Well, again, one of the things that, you know, all sort of Westminster democracies have as a detriment is there's a lot of power invested in the executive. And the executive is essentially unaccountable. I mean, it's supposed to be accounted to Parliament, but that's kind of devolved because if you vote against the executive, you've essentially kicked yourself out of a job. So now it's just sort of rote that you just do whatever they say. But what's leading into a greater secrecy, as you pointed out, is that, you know, even people who are in the government don't even kind of know what their own government is doing. I mean, we've been having a lot of stuff in the news again about backbenchers who are complaining that either they're being dictated to by the government or they're being told to keep quiet about item A or item B. And these are the people we've elected to do our job. The whole point of representative democracy is to have someone who represents us, who's informed and who knows what's going on. And as you point out, one of the things that would prevent against what you said, so let's say I'm Minister of Transportation, and in my department, myself or my minions somehow managed to do something that destroyed air traffic in Canada. Well, in theory, at one point, I would have to go to Parliament and say, hey, listen, planes don't work in Canada anymore, right? Sorry about that. And I'd lose my job. And it's that I lose my job part that's meant to keep me accountable. So we're really accountable for the departments. If they did something or their department did something, they fell on their sword and they went off into the sunset, so to speak. It's usually a career-ending sort of thing. But now it's like, hey, guys, sorry, we screwed up. But hey, I've got a new idea just down the road. And there's no longer that idea of accountability. We're losing accountability in our government. And one of the things that the Parliamentary Budget Officer helped do was to keep government accountable by saying, hey guys, they said this, but this is really what's happening. It makes you accountable and why it's so important.
All right. Well, this is Ethan, your free thinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
And this is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars.